That Sober Guy podcast contains adult content, merciless truth, and emotional nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
I'm Shane Ramey. You're listening to That Sober Guy podcast, and we help people stay sober. If it's your first time listening, welcome. I'm so glad that you're here today. Hope you're having a great day today. Thanks again for tuning in. If you're looking to cut back on your drinking, we have a great 30-day alcohol-free challenge out there. We also have lots of podcasts, other resources. You can get all of that and contact us by going to thatsoberguy.com. Also, be sure to follow us on Instagram at thatsoberguypodcast. You're never bringing me down. Our guest today is Jim Sonnefeld. And Jim is a songwriter, he's an author, speaker, and drummer for the iconic 90s rock band Hootie and the Blowfish. And lots of great things coming up for Jim in addition to the band. And we're going to talk about that today. Their upcoming tour coming up this year. They're going to do 50 shows across North America, as well as his book, Swimming with the Blowfish, Hootie Healing and One Hell of a Ride, which was released in 2022. So we'll talk a little bit about that. And then, of course, man, how do we quit drinking alcohol and live a better lifestyle, be better fathers, husbands, leaders in our communities, and actually have some fun in life? And I tell you, it's 100% possible. And as we're coming up on, oh, wow, very loud helicopter coming over my house right now. That was crazy. we're coming up on 10 years on the 26th of April since the first episode of That Sober Guy was launched. So I'm super excited about that. And it's really crazy and just an honor to be able to talk to amazing people and spread the good word of a great life free from alcohol and just doing some things that we enjoy to do and being God-led. And so excited to have Jim here to talk a little bit about his take on that. And Jim, it's great to have you on the podcast, man. Thanks for coming on.
My pleasure to be here and congrats on almost 10 years. That is not easy to achieve. That is pretty cool. And I Godspeed on going forward into your 11th or 12th year, maybe down the road.
Oh, man. Amen to that, man. Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, it's definitely been full of ups and downs. And I'm sure you can relate to that as a long career musician and author and, you know, just your own journey of recovery yourself. So let's kind of jump into that. Take us back. Like, what was your life like growing up? I think you're from the East Coast, and what did that look like as a kid for you, man?
Yeah, well, I mean, I had a great loving family. My parents both worked. I had five of us kids, and you know, it was a regular suburban neighborhood outside of Chicago, and so it was pretty cool. I wasn't ever starving. I wasn't ever unloved. I was as awkward as any little kid that grows up in anywhere, you know. Yeah. Self-conscious and thinking I was smarter than I was probably, but you know, looking just to be more comfortable in life. And I was into sports, I was into music, and so it was pretty great. We'd moved a lot earlier, and we finally settled in this town called Naperville, and it was pretty great. We had good schools, and like I said, got to connect with a lot of kids my age, and nice. It was all pretty, you know, fairly uneventful. I was a little squirt. I like to get in trouble. I like to defy authority. I like to get away with stuff. And that was before I turned 14 when I first was introduced to alcohol. Mm. And you know, a weird thing happened in that summer in between all my Christian school upbringing. And then I was going to a huge public school and I knew it. And I wanted to make these new friends. And it was just going to be a great thing. So by summertime, I was ready to start seeing what these kids from the public schools did.
Yeah. Gosh, it's so hard.
One night I found myself with a couple. Yeah. And I, you know, so I found myself with a group of people I wanted to hang out with before the fall semester started. Mm. And they, for the first time ever, I found myself around 14-year-old kids who were using drugs and alcohol, like out in the open. We were down by the river where nothing ever good happens down by the river, right? Let's get that clear.
Yeah, that's right. Chris Farley said it best. Down, you're going to end up in a van down by the river. Whatever. Yeah, definitely not a good take.
So, and, you know, no matter what my parents had told me or at my particular school / church, the priest had told me, or even the police who, because I had older brothers, I knew them too. Yeah. You know, they all said alcohol, you got to be 21. It's dangerous. Drugs are bad. They're dangerous. But once I got, you know, away from the parental eyes in front of kids that were 14 that looked like they were having a good time. I really was curious and I really did want to go for it. I wasn't so weirdly unadjusted that I, or maladjusted that I needed it to escape. I was just really curious about what that could give me. And so I went right for it. You know, I was like into whatever they had that night. And by the end of the night, sort of on my knees on the side yard, vomiting, of course. So at the end of my first attempt, it was, you know, drugs and alcohol one and little Jimmy zero. But I was also an athletic, competitive kid. I was like, I liked that feeling. I'm going to do it better next time. And I'm going to make that next time as soon as it can be. So I went on through high school and, you know, we had some good old party friends and consequences and but managed to get out of there in 4 years. Mm.
And were you, I know you mentioned before we were recording today, soccer. Was soccer a part of your life in high school as well, playing sports and trying to kind of fit in, and then you hang out with maybe some other athlete friends and then you find yourself, you know, partying on weekends. Is that kind of the take on that? Or?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when you're an athlete, and I played, you know, grew up playing tennis, baseball, football, basketball. And by 14, I was going to focus on soccer. And it's all, you know, it becomes a balance because you're wanting to be in shape. You're wanting to be ready for your teammates on the field. But then when you bring in drugs or alcohol, you're sort of balancing that thing, which is the opposite. It's bad for your body. So when I was 14, that was the first time where I suddenly was, you know, had to watch out and measure what I did on a Friday night compared to what I was going to have to do on a soccer field on Saturday or Sunday. So I remember thinking about that, but you know, I made a lot of bad choices. What do? You just do the best you can. And so I did. And, you know, I went on, my dream was to keep playing soccer, and I got to go to a Division I University of South Carolina and play Division I soccer. So 800 miles away. And the drinking age went down to 18 when I moved here, and there weren't as many, you know, my parents weren't here, and I was out of religious, you know, church or school.
Yeah.
And so I cranked it up another notch, you know, and yet the sport demanded way more of me. So again, I'm balancing my party life with my athleticism, and I unfortunately adore both of them.
Yeah, I totally get it.
A good enough job. I get through college in about 6 years. I play 4 years of ball at a very high level, and managed, even through some experimental partying and certainly consequences, you know, bad grades or getting in trouble with the coach or getting in trouble with friends, hurting people, hurting myself. I have all those things, bad relation problems. And yet I don't ever want to measure it really. I get through 6 years with my degree and I'm pretty pumped.
Yeah. Yeah. And so at that point, you're not really seeing it as an issue. It's just, you're kind of partying, having a good time, and it's not really having a huge effect on your life, it sounds like. How did you get into music? Was that in college, or did that kind of happen after the soccer career ended and transitioned into that? What did that look like?
I'd say I was kind of born a drummer. I was the little kid who, from the earliest age, was, you know, tapping spoons or my fingers or my feet and constantly annoying teachers and my parents because I couldn't stop this rhythm in my head that was manifesting outwardly. And I only got it under control when I took my first drum lessons at 13. And from there on out, I could at least perform it on the drum set.
Yeah.
And finally, like midway through college, when I saw, my gosh, my soccer career isn't going to keep going after college, I started getting back into music. So I was balancing, you know, I got in a band when I was in the middle of college for a little bit, took a gap year, really liked that lifestyle compared to the more rules and regulations of being a college athlete. And then as soon as I finished my fourth year of eligibility, joined another band. And then sort of the magic happens at the end of college. I meet a couple guys who want to do what I want to do, which is write our own music and be you know, authentic and original. And those guys are called Hootie and the Blowfish. They were looking for a drummer, and their drummer was leaving. And I thought, I'm getting with those guys. That's definitely what I want going to do. So we got our degrees, but sort of bought a van and had day jobs and focused primarily on making original music and trying to get the word out. And this is pre-internet, so there's no like, and it's pre, you know, recording Pro Tools or any of those good recording systems. You had to raise money to get into a good studio to make quality recordings. So we took, you know, party gigs that paid well and put the money towards studio time and trying to get gigs playing just our original music. We worked our tails off for and stayed in clubs, you know, which I kind of liked. I was, you know, again, not measuring my consequences or my intake as long as I wasn't the worst guy or the most disturbing guy or in the back of a cop car. I always felt like I was okay enough. So we spent a good 5 years growing that music and our fan base down here in South Carolina and on the East Coast. And we were getting along pretty good. We eventually quit our day jobs and we could all focus on songwriting, and we got a manager that was helping us out. And so by 94, we were kind of ready to go to the next level, if you will.
Yeah. So as you're doing that, when you're building up, are you, I'm assuming, you know, obviously in, when you're traveling and playing shows, it probably went by really fast, I would imagine. And you're playing parties, drinking, that kind of stuff is probably pretty regular at that point. Is it?
I loved that my job, my paycheck, though it was very meager, none of it, we weren't making a lot of money. We could just pay rent and put everything else back into getting insurance for the van or new tires or buy t-shirts to sell. It was all dumping it back in. Nobody was rich, but we were probably rich in spirit because we were having a good time. We were authentic. But I loved, you know, that every night that we played, there was an audience and I could drink. You know, it's one of the few areas where your paycheck is also in an environment that allows you to sort of camouflage what sort of partying you're doing. And since it is a party, no one is restraining you saying, oh, that's too much. That's rarely the case. Yeah. It's usually, drink more, act more stupid, and we're all having a good time and we'll forget about it tomorrow. But I was having consequences through those years in the clubs, and I thought I was leaving them in each town. And I quite liked the geographic change that we experienced, because on a Wednesday we might play Raleigh. And if I had a screw up, I hurt somebody, or I got in a fight, or I did something wrong, you know, I was off to DC the next day, and I thought I'm leaving that consequence behind, and I could do it all over again in DC. Cause the next night we were playing in Delaware, and I kept thinking and telling myself, we do that, right? We justify, we rationalize that it's not a problem cause it's in the rear view. And this is before cell phones, mind you. So there wasn't any of the activity following me around. I wasn't worried about finding myself on the internet the next day in some compromising position. There was no internet.
I know. Could you imagine, man, going, if go back to those days, if there was internet, oh, good Lord. Like, I think about that sometimes too, just the dumb stuff that I did and said, like, we're just not intelligent times, you know, intoxicated, like, gosh, man. And if I told my kids, I'm like, it follows you forever. Whatever you post, it follows you forever. Like, it's always going to be there. So just remember that.
I mean, I know I would have recorded a bunch of dumb stuff. You know, that's what we would have done. You do dumb stuff and you think that's what you want to capture. Views. So, because of that, you know, I thought I was escaping consequences often. You know, I'd move on and I'd be in another place. And it wasn't a great thing for me to get used to, but I did get used to it. And every night's a party when you're the band on stage. And so we got used to that lifestyle, and we really wanted to get a record deal. That was our whole goal, was like, if we get signed to a record label and put out a real nice album and get on the radio, that's the next level we were looking for. And that happened in 94. We got signed to Atlantic Records, and we were so jazzed, like, this could be it, you know, no guarantees, but we're going to have somebody else making a record with their money, and they might be able to get us on radio. So we went to LA. It was like a huge moment in our careers where we were a big band in a small pond here in South Carolina. And all of a sudden we're in LA in a real studio with a great producer, feeling like, oh, well, now we're like a really small fish in a really big pond. We're basically nobody, but, you know, we're thrilled to be there because we or just guys who are trying to live their dreams one day at a time. And, you know, you drive down on Sunset Boulevard all of a sudden and you see, you know, the Hollywood Bowl. These are like iconic things in a town where your dreams can be made. And we just kind of wondered, would ours be made or possibly crushed? Because there's no guarantee that when you make a great record that it gets on radio or that people like it or the record company, you know, puts all of their might behind you. And we got a little lucky. The album had been out for about 3 months and it wasn't doing anything. It was like, I like to joke, on the top 40 charts, we're number 157. So we were hanging in there, but we weren't making any big noises. And this guy, so I like to say that luck is where preparation meets opportunity. That's what it said in my high school weight room. And we got lucky in August of 94, after the record had been out, David Letterman, who had the biggest late night show at the time in the 90s, heard our song on the radio in New York on his way home from work and said, give me that band on the show. So we got a call to be on national TV. So instead of being in front of 500 or 1,000 fans one night at a time, we're going to be in front of 6 million viewers for our 3.5 minutes of song. And after that night, our life sort of changed. Letterman loved repeating us the name and kind of used it as a gag. People liked the song. Radio stations were playing it. And suddenly we were, by the next summer, going to be playing amphitheaters instead of clubs. Wow. So it was a big, big change for us.
I really love that. Luck is where, would you say luck is where preparation and
meets opportunity.
Yeah. That's such a good, it's a good way to say that. You know, 'cause for anyone out there listening or just in what we do the day to day, whatever business we're in, sometimes you're working hard and you just feel like you're not making any ground. You take a step back and, you know, two steps back, and then it can be a long, long process sometimes, but hanging in there and just being diligent about it and whatever we're doing, that goes with trying to stay sober as well. That's not easy. That's a day. That's a grind. Going to the gym, showing up every day. And I feel like when we do that, good things will happen. And maybe they're not always exactly what we expect them to be or want them to be, but good things do happen when we do that. And I think that's a great example of that with you guys. Just grinding. You did that for many years. Were you shocked at how fast that happened? Because I'm sure that happened really, really fast. Like all of a sudden, even though there was a long buildup, it's like, boom, like, wow, we kind of made it. Like, what was that like?
Yeah, no, it was bizarre. And it kind of alters your whole state of being because you've worked hard. And like I said, we modestly enjoyed making music and getting to play each night in front of fans without a record label. Now we're on the radio all over the country and playing to sold out amphitheaters, and Letterman is talking about us on TV. It's like, what's happening? It's like a shock. So you sort of just put on your blinders and go with it. And we did. So we started playing. We end up, that record starts taking off and sells a lot of records. It goes to number one numerous times. And over the next year, it's just a crazy pinch me moment. And, you know, but then, you know, similar, I guess, to a hangover, you wake up and you're like, okay, can I repeat what I did last night? Can I keep it going?
Yeah.
Or not? So maybe it's not like a hangover. Maybe it's like something else. But, you know, we wanted to hold on to it. So we put out a second record and we put out a third record. And, you know, before you know it, just as fast as life was going and the fame happened, we're at the end of the 90s and three records into a career that looks like it's now going back down the other side of the mountain. So fame overall is pretty amazing. And if you're lucky enough to get there, it can be an amazing gift, but it's rarely lifelong. And so I had to face, and probably where I struggled emotionally and spiritually, and then, you know, chemically, is that I didn't know what to do when I realized the good years were behind us. We had about 5 years at the top, and then it was obvious that there were some new bands that were cooler and younger, and our record company wasn't going to keep pushing us. So we started going downwards after 2000, and that's, I didn't know what to do. So I did what always seemed to work to feel better or to make me think that I'm, I don't know, in a place of achievement or celebration, yeah, is that I drank. I used alcohol to say, we're all good here, right? Yeah. I know it looks like the boat's going down, but I still got my glass up because I want to feel good. And that suddenly became this real bad cycle that I was not getting out of. At 2001, 2002, we started having kids. Next thing you know, there's, you know, a kid and then a second child in our family, and I'm a wreck. You know, the partying that I couldn't turn off on the road has been brought home, and those things don't match.
Yeah.
You know, waking up with kids. So it got really messy, and it was messy at home, and it became messy on the road because I couldn't turn it off. I couldn't control it. You know, it's like once I started, the craving started, and I couldn't control what the end game would be. And sometimes maybe not a big consequence, but often it was regret, yeah, and shame and guilt for my behavior. So next thing you know, the intervention start. Maybe some of you have been there where you think the worst and most horrible people in the world are the ones who are sitting in front of you telling you that you drink poorly or you drug poorly and that they love you and they're worried about you. But honestly, in retrospect, those are the people that could see my life most clearly. And I'm thankful today for all of the interventions I received in the early 2000s because those people were willing to honestly tell me the truth that they were worried about me. And I wasn't even willing to do that for myself.
Yeah. Yes. I can feel that. I know that what that's like to be in that moment where you don't know, man. You just like, and you feel like the weight of the world is on your shoulders and you know you want to change, but you just don't know how the heck to do it. And you kind of maybe feel attacked even like, you know, I'm not as bad as, you know, this guy or that. I didn't do this. Makes it easy to justify. One of the things I was thinking about too, you mentioned, you know, going to a Christian school as a kid. So I don't know what your relationship with God was at that time, but did you feel God kind of tugging on your heart at any point in that, like in, especially being a father, trying to like live, you know, have a family? Did you feel any of that as you were questioning like the lifestyle that you were in?
Yeah. I mean, what little intuition I had, you know, that thing on the inside that's telling you something,
yeah,
that voice, or maybe you perceive it as God. When the consequences continued coming and when the interventions continued going, you're like, I think something is wrong. And most, I think, addicts kind of know the chemicals they're putting in their body are a major part of the problem. I had this feeling, and that's what I was fighting. If I could just justify my behavior to people, then maybe I wouldn't feel this intuition that I'm the problem.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. And, you know, when I left, you know, home when I was 18, I didn't want to go back to church. I was not hip on the things I was taught, sort of maybe the childhood version of Christianity and some of those stories. They weren't making sense to me as I got older. So I had drifted very far away from anything that was in the Bible or any looking for spirituality necessarily. I wanted ideas. I wanted someone to show me the way. I just didn't want it to be the old way that I didn't like and I had still some entanglement with. So, until I got very desperate, I'll say this, you know, the biggest intuition I had or moment where I felt like maybe there is something bigger than me that's working was the last day I ever drank, which my last intervention came out of a strange source, my 4-year-old daughter at the time. I had built a music studio behind our house, detached, so I could go back there and have some separation so I could write songs, but also mainly party. And I was isolated by that time. I was okay partying with myself and drinking and using various drugs. So I had stayed out up very late in the studio and hadn't made it back into my own house. And here comes my daughter at 10:30 on a Sunday morning. I can hear feet coming up the stairs and she plops on my chest all bright and energetic. And I'm in rough shape. And she says 4 simple words. She says, Dad, what are you doing? And, you know, typically, and here's why I think there was some movement that I can't define necessarily, is that normally I would have some excuse, right? It's not easy to say something to a 4-year-old to get him off your back don't have to explain what you're doing. And she repeated it, Dad, what are you doing? And she just meant, what are you doing out here while we're all in there? Well, you know, and I'd heard a few times before where she would ask why I was wearing the same clothes as the night before when I read her, you know, night story, or why I smelled like I did, which was usually like bourbon, which was my drink of choice. And, you know, I always had some answer. And on this morning, something was working. And she finally said it one more time, "Dad, what are you doing?" And got frustrated because I didn't say anything. And she ran back inside. And I was left sitting there sort of in this moment, kind of looking up like, wow, what am I doing? I mean, it was the first time ever something was urging me to answer that question honestly. And I'd never had that intuition before. And I finally just said to no one in particular, or God perhaps, "I don't know what I'm doing. I'm out of control. I'm pretty sure the drugs and alcohol are the main source, but my behavior in general is horrid, and I don't love myself. I don't even like myself." And that is the day that I decided to call somebody who had offered me their phone number, like a good 12-stepper might do, is to say, "Hey, I love you, man. Looks like you're struggling. Call me if you ever want to see the way that I've taken." And this is a guy who'd been clean and sober for about a year. So I called him that morning and began the journey.
Man, I love it. As you were saying that, all I hear in my head is surrender, 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 surrender. Like, that is the key. Like, that is, I mean, there, and you know, there's a few different components to, there's a lot of components actually to all this, but man, that first thing is just like that surrender. And I remember that moment too. Like, and it's so confusing and so hard, but so relieving at the same time. Just like, I remember feeling the weight of the world just lifted off of me. Just, I mean, I'm getting chills right now, just having a little quick flashback of it. But I could picture you sitting in that chair and just surrender, surrender. And like, man, it's funny too, how kids have a strong connection to God, in my opinion, and what I see, that childlike spirit. And there's something that God can use through kids to speak to us. And I really believe that's something was very special with your daughter, man. That's incredible. It's pretty crazy, man.
Yeah.
You know? And so,
I mean, they're more honest than most adults are willing to be. Let's get that right out there. Kids they're not worried about what you think of them. My daughter was worried about why I wasn't with my family again.
Yeah.
And why I was sitting out there on a couch by myself on a Sunday morning. Yeah. It was bluntly honest. And an adult wouldn't even, you know, be that honest, except for maybe the people who intervened on me that loved me. But, you know, so she said something that was profound. I didn't want to surrender because society had told me for years in my male, you know, upbringing, surrender is weak.
Yeah.
Surrender is you're a loser. So that didn't ever occur to me, like, I'm not going to surrender. But to answer the question, what am I doing? That's a little, I don't know what I'm doing. And so,
isn't that, it's so relieving. I don't know.
I found something amazing for maybe the first time in my life. And I was 40. I was, you know, getting up there in years when I, on that day. And he brought me to a place, and, you know, in a 1 hour meeting with some people who were sitting around who had their struggles. And it was a 12-step meeting. And, you know, I found this amazing power of transparency where people were being honest with themselves and outwardly towards me. And I didn't know them. And they were talking about the horrible places they'd been, the bad decisions they had made, and the consequences. Yet they had this lightness, this like rebirth attitude about them. And I just fell so much in love with it. Though I didn't want to surrender because of my macho attitude, I did want an answer. And when they provided that answer in front of me, I was like, oh my gosh, I'm taking that. You tell me there's an answer for my problem. Because I felt like I was just like they were describing, right? You sit around a bunch of addicts and they talk about stuff honestly. You go, oh yeah, I do that too.
I'm not alone. Imagine that.
Right? And so, that was, I guess, my journey back to deciding maybe I do need God. And I didn't know if I wanted that either. That took a little bit of sitting around in front of people and hearing their experience and strength and hearing their different journeys, all sorts of journeys. But it gave me some encouragement and inspiration to say, to get in here, I just need an ounce of, you know, willingness and maybe open-mindedness to believe and start some new ideas because my old ones weren't working.
So would you say that it was, you know, an attempt or in through this process that you're kind of coming to terms with some different things in life. And one of them, like, how did you separate being, you know, Jim, the drummer from Hootie and the Blowfish versus Jim, the dad, the husband, just the regular dude who wants to live a good life and like enjoy his family and have some fun. You know, I would imagine there's a back, cause fame would, I would imagine would do that to you too, a little bit. It messes with your ego. It messes with your head a little bit. And you crave that attention probably, you know, being on stage. Like, so how did you kind of separate that as you're trying to work to get sober at the same time?
Well, one of the first things, and I heard it through sort of the principles that are, I guess, the foundation of the 12-step model, is that I learned that my problems are of my own making. And it wasn't that I traveled a lot. It wasn't that I had adoring fans and that I'd been a big deal on television for a period and now I wasn't. That's ego. It was that my problems were of my own making and I have control of discovering them. I can do a step work that'll provide me with the answers to why I think why the way I do. So I discovered some things that allowed me to go forward and continue to be a traveling musical guy because I discovered my flaws. I mean, I discovered my failures, my limitations and my weaknesses, and I wasn't going to let them overpower me or dominate me. I discovered I have fear. You know, when I discovered I have pride, I have lust, I practice self-pity. I'm addicted to the drug of your approval. I just so desperately want to be approved of. And these are sicknesses, right? And so when I start working with a, you know, guy I call my sponsor, doing some of the steps, I'm empowering myself to realize it's not somebody's fault. There's no one to blame. This is a thing that's fixable, that comes from within. I've got to change my thoughts and ideas because those become the father of my actions, right? So I've got to get in. And that's why for me, writing out my 4-step inventory through the 12-step model was so important because it became instantly real. Compared to the place where I'd always tried to solve problems, right? In between my ears, justifying, rationalizing, I got this, I can figure it out, blah, blah. But when you write it out and you look at it, that's real. There's no change in that. And, and it's a fearful for a lot of people. Obviously I was a little scared of it too, but when I looked at it, I said, these are flaws, they're defects, but I'm going to work through them and not let them dominate me. And that's what the pathway provides after that. Right.
Yeah.
Whether you're working with a sponsor in any 12-step model, it shows you the way to start peeling back that onion. So you can discover what's underneath. If we can't get to the root, we're just going to keep growing weeds again, right?
Oh, yeah, totally, man. And a lot of that stuff is buried and you don't know. You don't even remember it sometimes until you put it on paper. There's a lot of it is subconscious, just buried down in there. And so that pen to paper is so powerful. And then that's the first part of it. And then talking about it with somebody that you trust and that, that you can be open with and you can really let that stuff out. It's extremely, extremely powerful. We got about 10 minutes. I just want to be, you know, honorable of time here today. And I want to get into what life's like today. But first, before we do that, I just want to ask you one thing, Jim. Like, what would you say? I mean, there's so many dudes that listen to this that I get emails and, man, I just don't know where to start. Like, you know, I've got 2 weeks and then I fall back into it. What would you say just to the newcomer out there who's interested, man? They know that they have an issue, they want to stop, but they just don't know where to start or what to do. Any advice or thoughts for them?
Yeah, as the same problem I had, which was I felt I knew some things, I had some skills and smartness in life that worked in a lot of areas of my life, but the one thing I didn't know anything about was recovery and rebirth, and I needed people around me to help flush that out, to connect myself. And I tried to do it alone and it never worked. So here's the hard part that nobody wants to hear, is you need other people. We can't isolate and get well. So kind of got to get over ourselves and say, I'm going to reach out to a group, because I know, and the listeners know, there are groups to reach out to. You just click on your web browser and you know where to go. 12-step groups, even therapy, counseling, and be willing to do three things that are very difficult. H-O-W, how? Honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. We got to break down these barriers that we're honest enough. We're not honest enough until we get down to the root of the truth. We got to open up our minds a little bit. Somebody famous once said, our minds work like a parachute. They're best when opened. So we got to.
That's good. Yeah.
It's a creeper, like, isn't it, Shane? Yeah. So we got to be open-minded that maybe there's more out there that we don't understand or know, and just be willing to take those steps. It's just one step at a time, and you can do it because there's people. Here's the guarantee. There's people waiting for you. There's people that want to work with newcomers. I'm one of those people. Like, that's how I do it today. You asked me about, you know, what life is like today and what it looks like. I'll go right into that. I'm sober today because newcomers reach out and say, I need help. And I get to show them the journey. I get to walk them the journey that I've already walked. And that's what keeps me going today. I know some people get clean and maybe they stop going to meetings or they think that's enough. But for me, that's definitely not enough. No more than a Christian thinking that a 30-minute sermon on Sunday morning is enough for a 7-day week. I mean, that's not enough. It's called nourishment. We need a daily nourishment. Nobody does one day of nourishment a week and is as good as they can be, in my opinion. Yeah. So I hang out with a big 12-step community here in Columbia, South Carolina. When I travel with the band, I go to meetings on the road. I do speaker meetings whenever possible. Some of the music that I make in the last decade or so, my solo music, is leaning into solutions and celebrating God and celebrating the recovery process and the rebirth. So a lot of that music, I get to go out and sing in front of people who are looking and seeking for God. And I love to do that. That's the connection that just keeps me alive today, is that I can represent myself. Still, I get to go out with Hootie. Yeah, that's great. It's rock and roll. It's a big party. I'm the one sober guy. It's cool. But it's the smaller crowds of recovery or people or seekers that I just really relish.
Yeah. Do you do a lot of prep work before you go out on tour? Like you guys are about to go out on a 50-show tour this year. Is there prep work involved for you? Like knowing where there's maybe a meeting, whatever town you're in, bringing your own, you know, NA drinks or bringing your own food or whatever that looks like. Do you kind of have a plan going into that usually when you're out?
Yeah, I mean, my crew around me, I mean, my band and our big Hootie family and are the people that work with us and for us, they're all so very supportive. So I want to give them props because they know that I've been sober. I'm in my 20th year now. So they've seen me around enough that I'd probably like the new me better than the old me. And so they support me. They lift me up. And I make time for meetings on the road. Believe me, compared to when I first started going to meetings, it's a lot easier now. We got the meeting guide apps. We got all this stuff. I used to have to go to a town, find a phone in the production office at the venue, call the intergroup on 411 and ask the guy, is there any meetings? I'm in Dallas and I need a meeting. And they'd give you the address to write down with a pen. And then you had to find a ride because they didn't have Uber. It was a lot of work. So back then there was a hell of a lot more prep than there is now. Now it's just scheduling and Uber and go meet some wonderful people. Who doesn't love a visitor at their meeting, right?
That's right. Yeah, always good. Well, man, this has been great to chat with you. I'll just bring it back to, for those out there listening, like as dudes, as men, fathers, husbands, just trying to be better human beings. Like, I'll bring it back to what Jim said in his studio that day. It's okay to say, I don't know. Like, I don't know. I don't have to have all the answers to everything. I don't have to know every little thing. Like, that's okay. Like that surrender piece and whatever it is that you're going through right now, it's okay to just sit back and accept it. And there's lots of resources out there. We got a lot of them at thatsoberguy.com. And we got Jim's book as well, Swimming with the Blowfish, Hootie Healing, and One Hell of a Ride. We put the link to the show notes in there. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the book too, Jim?
Yeah, thanks. You know, I'm so excited because I've heard a lot from the recovery community that they're enjoying that part of the story. It's, you know, a little bit of my childhood, how I got to South Carolina and found my bandmates and the music we got to create and enjoy and celebrate. But really, it was how I subtly found that path downward into addiction and what I did to get out of it. And, you know, it's all about the way out. We all want to know the way out. We have different problems and different addictions. But so it talks about the way out. And there's a, you know, fun ending to the story, a couple twists at the end that you don't see coming. So nice. I won't spoil any of that. Pick up the book. You can get it at, you know, where's the people? Oh, Amazon. It'll be there in an hour, right?
I know. It's so weird. I'm still trying to figure out how the heck they do that. I order something and it's here 3 hours later. Like, how does that happen? It's like magic. It's like there's a wizard. He's just dropping it off on my porch. I got a new thing of pomade in 2 hours and 47 minutes. I'm like, man, it's crazy. I know. Crazy stuff, man.
Oh, man. But yeah, it's about the journey. And I couldn't have started writing it until I'd been clean probably over 12 years to get some idea of who I was and what man I could be. Because it's not just staying clean. It's wanting to be a better husband, like you said, father. And
yeah.
And we've got a big family here, and it takes a lot. And you got to, you know, there's a preacher out of Atlanta that he talks about making better decisions for fewer regrets. And that sums up what I've been given freely by so many people in the 12-step rooms and my sponsors, that's what we want, right? I got to make better decisions because I want fewer regrets.
Yeah. Absolutely. I love that. It's a great way to put it too. Where's the best place for folks to connect with you, Jim?
Man, I'm on Facebook a little bit. I admit it. I even read the messages and will send some back on occasion. Nice. But I don't like looking at news. I don't like looking at current events. I like to spread spiritual joy and hear back about others, some of their struggles and also their victories. And that's how I stay connected. And Spotify and all the streamers have my music. I've got some stuff out there that's contemporary Christian, some other stuff that's just positive reinforcement sort of music. Wow. And so check it out. There's some pretty fun musical projects out there. And look forward to catching up with you all somewhere.
Yeah, I love it, man. And we'll put all those links today in the show notes so they're very easy for you to find. And man, Jim, thanks, bro. It's been a really good time chatting with you. And thanks for coming on That Sober Guy podcast.
Amen, brother.
I hope something spoke to you today. Share the podcast with a friend. Connect with us on Instagram at That Sober Guy podcast. Peace, love, and respect. Keep your blood clean.
Very cool. How have you done 10 years?